time on the show, a corporate machine has its place, Mary Sue and Gary Stu, and Jim Henson was a complicated guy. All this and more on Comics Are Great. And we're going, and then, you know, I didn't even really think about where I was going to put this recording, but let's just assume that it's going to go into Comics Are Great feed. So I'll say Comics Are Great visual storytelling show. This is not a live episode. This is a very special episode and an emergency recording episode, a personal episode. And I'll get through the introductions fast. Dave Roman, YayTime.com, Astronaut Academy, Teen Boat, Agnes Quill, Comics Bakery, whole bunch of stuff. Hey, Dave.
Hey. Thanks for
having
this emergency.
Well, thank you for making the time to be here because, you know, I went and saw the Muppets, this past weekend. And then immediately upon leaving the theater, I was like, I got to hear what Dave has to say about this movie. Because I know that you are a big time Muppets lover. So
I am, yeah. More so than sometimes I realize. Every now and then I think, oh, I'm not that big a Muppet fan. I can't, you know, sing the songs or anything. But
I bet you can sing. You could sing Mississippi Mud. I bet you know all the lyrics to that.
No.
Oh.
But now I'll have the song stuck in my head. All. but I have watched like everything. So this movie was kind of the new movie, The Muppets, was definitely interesting because I felt like the movie, I have a lot of opinions on it and they're very conflicted. But more than anything, I thought in some ways it was like a giant guilt trip to the world who hasn't maybe kept up with The Muppets as much, which I was certainly free of because I've seen all the Muppet movies post Henson.
We should probably say that we're going to talk about this new Muppets movie, and we're probably going to spoil a lot of things. So if you're nutty about spoilers, don't listen to this episode until after you have seen the Muppets.
Yeah, and I will say also, if you're nutty about opinions, which I'm finding even more so than spoilers lately, I've been kind of an opinion purist.
What does that mean?
Just in this day and age of Twitter. And the internet, where everybody puts their opinions on the internet like so fast, like the minute they see a movie, they're like, that was great, or that was horrible, or that didn't live up to expectations, or, you know, they'll start complaining about things and maybe not even giving details away, but just sort of setting the tone. I find myself now going to see movies. I have to see them before that. I am exposed to that because I don't want to spend the movie going, why didn't they like this? Oh, I thought this was so good. What was their problem? Why didn't they appreciate this? Or, man, what was all the hype about? This movie is nowhere near as good as everybody on the blogosphere is saying.
Oh, you know what? This is where I was lucky. I was not paying any attention to this Muppets film or what anybody was saying about it.
Right.
This was totally off my radar. I had no intention of going. Anne just dragged me to it and said, like, yeah,
oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. I was like, you know what? The Muppets, you know, it's going to be a bunch of crude jokes. It'll be a bunch of Saturday Night Live stuff. Without Jim Henson, it's not going to be very good. And this idea of reinventing or going back to the franchise's roots, that never works. So I just really don't care. I'll wait for it to come out on Netflix or something.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah. Well, I had mixed, you know, reservations as well, not exactly the same as yours. So that's part of why I had to see it right away, is because I wanted to know, you know, did it pass my own test before I could start getting into the larger question of how it plays to the world and whether or not, you know, Jason Segel was a good person or a bad person to relaunch a franchise that I...
Oh, the qualifier at the end. That was cute. For a second there, I thought you were just going to say whether he's a good person or a bad person, period.
Oh, no, I think he's a good person. And, I think that, you know, I went in with a little bit of skepticism, but also a little bit of hopes, because I'm a fan of Freaks and Geeks. I thought that Forgetting Sarah Marshall was a really funny movie. And in all his interviews, it's been very clear that he's very passionate about the Muppets and comes from a real, you know, sort of fan place. And I think that that sort of complicates the issues in some ways. But where should we start? Because I could go in so many different directions.
Let's just go wherever you want to. I don't want this thing to feel too formatted. I just want.
So
this
we were
to...
talking about guilt trips. I guess that yeah. was those the that was I thought it was yeah. You made a really good point about how it in some ways acts like the last 12 years haven't happened, and that was something that before seeing the movie was a little discomforting to me as a Muppet fan because. On all the interviews and stuff, like everybody's like, "Oh, you haven't been around for 12 years. 12 years, you've been gone." But for people like me who have watched all the things in between, and they've made a million clips, and they've done internet things, and they've been on TV shows, it's a little weird to act like they've been completely gone.
Yeah.
Whereas I think the movie, in some ways, is a little bit more accurate. The movie itself, when they sort of go into just this idea that the world has moved on. There's probably, I mean, I think that that strikes a little closer to the truth, actually. But I was surprised at how overt they were about that. Because you saw Superman Returns, right?
Oh, yeah.
One of the things that I thought that was sort of funny about that movie was that they try to sort of put Superman into today's context by acting as if, like, well, the world doesn't need Superman anymore. And, you know, we've moved past that idealistic time where truth, justice, and the American way, you know, really can fly. So the movie tries to, like, have its cake and eat it, too, by sort of making you feel like, oh, yeah, the world has moved on, and then being like, but no, not really, or whatever. And I felt like the Muppets movie definitely was trying to go for that same exact tone, where they're trying to act like, oh, the world has become this harsh, you know, place where Punch Your Teacher is the number one show, whatever. But at the same time being like, you know, but don't forget us, because obviously but it's just so weird because everybody who is seeing the movie has, you know, they're paying to see the movie, they want to see the Muppets, and yet in some ways they're being lectured and sort of given this like weird guilt trip about it.
Good point. Really good point. I didn't take it as a guilt trip as much as, but now that looking at that, that totally was what it was. It's like, why has everybody forgotten us? Why has the world lost their way? What's wrong with the world today that we can't remember how to sing and laugh?
Which is an interesting, I mean, that's an interesting angle. I'm not going to deny that, but what I think was sort of too bad. And I should preface all of this by saying I enjoyed the movie. I'm going to sound like I'm the big bummer on the movie. And in some ways I'm more disappointed in myself than I am in the film.
Oh, Dave, you're making me feel sad.
No, don't feel sad. You know, but this is something that I've been struggling with my whole life. My mom used to always give me a lot of guff for, you know, she's always like, why can't you just enjoy something? It's like, I'll see something and I'll be like, you know, just start tearing it apart and dissecting it and overthinking every little thing. But, you know, I own the movie. I love it. I'll watch it 50 times, but it's a complicated relationship that I have with things that I love sometimes.
So you spend a lot of time overanalyzing stuff and like what your reactions are to the things that you love.
Yeah. And I feel like this movie really pushes a lot of buttons for someone like myself, who is a longtime fan, because the Muppets are such a unique brand that have gone on for so long and been so connected to very specific people. And there's so many different jump off points where people could be like, you know what? Once Jim Henson died, I was out.
Yeah.
Or, you know, once Disney took them over, now I have, you know, these corporation anxiety feelings, or, you know, now someone, an outsider has taken over the Muppets and he's, you know, bringing his own spin to it. So there's a lot of things that you know, could go wrong or right, I guess, depending on how you view it. But
right.
But I did enjoy the movie. I had fun watching it. I think that it's really funny. I think it's really entertaining. But I'm not sure that I view it as a true Muppet movie. I think this is how I've come to terms with it, is that I think I enjoyed it as a Flight of the Conchords movie starring Jason Siegel and a lot of Muppet cameos, more so than a true Muppet movie. Or I think it's sort of similar to, did you ever see the Brady Bunch movie?
Oh, no. No, I never did.
Oh, it's actually really funny. But it's the same kind of thing as this movie, where it's made by people who grew up huge fans of the property. They loved the Brady Bunch growing up. So they kind of are like hyper aware of like what the touch points are. Like, what are the cultural touch points that everybody knows about the Brady Bunch?
Marsha. Yeah, that kind of
thing. Yeah, exactly. Like all the episodes that are like the classic scenes, and they make sure that all those things are addressed. And it has just enough irony to know that you're like, this is an update. And yet it's still, you can tell that the people really love the Brady Bunch, and that the movie at the end of the day celebrates it and makes you realize actually the Brady Bunch is pretty awesome. And it's actually like a really good feel good movie. I felt like this Muppet movie is exactly that. It's Jason Segel and his cohorts are huge fans of the Muppets. They grew up loving it, and they want to go back to the exact version of the Muppets that they first fell in love with. And they're trying to make something that's like reminding everybody, like, remember how great they were at this very specific point in time. And I kind of actually walked away with a bit of like, wow, this is sort of like a fanfic, like an ultimate fanfic version of the Muppets. And Raina actually pointed me to an article afterwards, after I was like going on this rant. She's like, wait, have you read the article where they basically say that this movie is just like the ultimate fanfic? I was like, no. And I actually just read it last night. And I disagree with certain of the things in the article. And that's sort of like, that's where, like, why I keep saying my relationship with this thing is complicated, because I keep swinging in different directions on how I feel, about it. But let's talk about you, Jersey.
No, you're highlighting a lot of interesting thoughts. And when you say fanfic, you know, one of the things that I was stricken by that I thought was really clever about the movie, where I was like kind of caught off guard and pleasantly surprised by, is the vehicle character. This is where we get into spoilers. The vehicle character, yeah, of Walter. And you start out with Walter and his brother. I forget his brother's name, but Jason Segel plays the character. And
His name is actually Gary.
Okay.
Like Gary Stew.
Gary Stew. Yeah. What am I missing here?
And his girlfriend is Mary. And like fanfic, like the classic fanfic names are Gary and Mary Stew.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Gosh, that's going back to
our
Mary Sue discussion.
Yep.
Funny. But Walter is clearly, from the get-go, you see he's a Muppet. And we, the audience, know, okay, he's a Muppet. He just doesn't realize it yet. And he can't quite put his finger on why he loves the Muppet so much, why he's such a fan. And this becomes this huge metaphor for like what the Muppets apparently meant to Jason Segel, is like, oh, I'm an outsider, I'm weird, I'm different. And this band of weirdos who are eternally trying for things and always failing but never giving up hope that they'll eventually do it. And I remember reading something somewhere where somebody said that's like maybe it was even Jerry Jewell who said this. The secret of the Muppets is that they're all eternally failing at what they most want to do, but they just keep going, right? Like Fozzie wants to be funny, he's not funny. Gonzo wants to be an artist, but his art is too bizarre for people to understand. Kermit wants to rally the troops, but it's almost impossible for him to do so. So, and that's what's fun to watch, at least according to the thing I read. So for Walter, it's like, that's what, you know, they're like me. It's like, I'm an outsider. I'm weird. I'm always trying at things, and I'm never feeling like I'm there. And you know, we're all familiar with the vehicle character, the cute kid in the movie who we're supposed to identify with, Hogarth Hughes in The Iron Giant, or, you know, Spike and Sparkplug in The Transformers, later on Sari in The Transformers. There's countless examples of the human, Pete's dragon, right? The kid and the dragon.
Yeah.
There's countless examples of this. This is the kid that we're supposed to map ourselves onto, and we're living through his fantasy. But by making it a Muppet, it's like now they're playing with cartoons here. They're playing with the cartoon where we can map ourselves onto this kid more easily because he is, after all, a cartoon instead of like a real person. And so when Kermit says to Walter at the end, well, why don't you join us? Why don't you come up and let's thank you? It's the moment we, the audience or Muppets fans, have all dreamed of Kermit turning to us and saying, hey, why don't you join us? So he becomes like this ultimate meta Mary Sue for us all, the audience, to get sucked into. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. And this actually kind of goes, and why it does tie into my whole Mary Sue conversation, is because one of the things that always bothered me when people were throwing around Mary Sue and the term self-insert fanfic and all this kind of thing is because usually people throw that around and it's always negative. It's always like a clear negative. And I always felt like, you know, sometimes it isn't. Like sometimes, like just because someone is sort of going through the process that people can use to, you know, to designate something as fanfiction, I don't think that that means that it's pure negative. And I think that this is an example where you're absolutely right. The character of Walter is Jason Siegel. And the name Walter actually is based off his first puppet that he created when he was a kid.
Oh my gosh.
So when he, you know, so here is this kid who grew up loving the Muppets, dreaming of, you know, being a part of the Muppets, and then got to make a Muppet movie. And what does he do? He puts himself in the movie. He's the main, you know, human character, but then he creates a Muppet based on himself as a kid and names it after his first puppet when he was, you know, designing puppets as a kid.
Whoa. right? All this recursive storytelling going on.
Right. So now in theory, you hear that and you think, oh, that's a train wreck. That's bad. Like that's so amateur. And yet even like really hardcore Muppet fans seem to walk out of that movie and think, hey, Walter was actually kind of cool. They did a good job with him. And for the most part, even when you know that that's sort of like this, wow, this movie is a big, you know, guilty pleasure thing for the person involved, it works. It's really funny. I actually don't think that there's anything bad about Jason Siegel in the movie. I don't think...
I was really surprised at... You know that one of my big chips on my shoulders is when... a movie aimed at young people or accessible to young people comes off as being affected or insincere or, mm-hmm. you know, the adult talking down to an audience or saying, gather around children and we'll regale you with this story. This is good for you after all. That's one of the things that just, oh, I shut off like a lamp whenever I hear that kind of, when I feel that in a movie. And, you know, song and dance numbers, I also get equally irritated when they do it ironically, you know? Like the movie Enchanted, and that's why I thought it was really great. The gal that they got to be in this movie, I forget her name. The
Amy Adams.
Yeah, but she was also in that movie Enchanted, which I thought was fantastic.
I love Enchanted.
It played to that kind of sweet sincerity in a way that felt honest, but at the same time, kind of winking at it. But it wasn't.
Enchanted actually is very much. It's just like the Brady Bunch movie. And this movie, I would put all three of those movies in the exact same category because they're teasing, you know, certain tropes and sort of addressing the, you know, the universal wink, wink, nod, nod. Like we all know that these certain things are going to happen, but it's also celebrating them at the same exact time. Like Enchanted loves all those old Disney movies, you know, and there's all these little cameos of, you know, the voice actresses who played Ariel and Jasmine. They're all like in that movie.
As if they're saying like, oh, isn't this corny, but isn't it great? You know, it has that vibe to it, which I totally can get behind. I love that. So I thought she was a great piece of casting in this because the song and dance numbers, like as soon as they started singing, I was like, oh, here we go. This is where it's going to turn into them making fun of the song and dance number. And they didn't. I felt like it came across like really like sincere and honest. Like they were trying their level best to make it feel just like it did when you watched The Great Muppet Caper.
Yeah, and I think that was that's where at the end of the day, like I respect Jason Siegel, and I think he made really good choices. And one of the biggest ways was casting or hiring Brett McKenzie to write the songs because are you familiar with The Flight of the Conchords?
I'm familiar with them, but I'm not deeply familiar with them.
Right. Like that show and their music, it walks that exact same line where it's making fun of certain genres of music. But it's also celebrating them, and it's that kind of thing where it's like you're laughing, but you're laughing with them, and at the end of the day, you're appreciating everything that's happening. So it's like this like universal, it's ironic sincerity or something. I don't even know how to
irony.
Like the musical. I mean, again, like we're going total spoilers here. You know, at the end of the first big musical number, then everybody drops and they're like, "Woo, it's over!" You know. So there is that sort of like fourth wall breaking.
But that was great Muppet Caper. I mean, they broke the fourth wall like crazy. God.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And that's one of Anne's biggest beefs with that movie. Like, she and I argue over which is better, Muppets Take Manhattan or Great Muppet Caper, and I maintain Great Muppet Caper because it's the most beautiful piece of fourth wall breaking where it doesn't feel forced or silly. Fourth wall breaking is so dangerous because it often turns into, can you believe this crap that I'm dealing with right now?
Yeah.
That old joke. But in Great Muppet Caper, it just became like there's like two stories going on simultaneously.
Yeah, the whole thing. Is like that. Like, yeah, that's what I love. Like, I actually just rewatched all the original three before going to see this one, just to sort of put it into context.
Oh God, you're awesome.
I told you I'm crazy. But yeah, I actually walked away like really into the Muppet Caper more than I ever had. Like, I feel like that one's aging really well. And I think, yeah, the fourth wall, like the fact that they're sort of relentless about the meta-ness of the fact that they know they're in a movie and that they're playing these characters. And the running joke about them being twin brothers is just hilarious.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, that one is great. You know, even Fozzie can't tell them apart at some point.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Also, the way the movie kicks off, the way it kicks off with them in a balloon, it's all peaceful and sweet. And then all of a sudden, the balloon falls to the ground, and then Kermit says, wow. And then it's like a million people dancing, cars smashing into things, chickens in the air, and it's just chaos, absolute chaos, with these three happy Muppets dancing in front of the screen saying, hey, a movie.
Yeah.
Oh man, is there anything more cheerful than that? Anything? I defy anybody to find something that's more distilled sweetness and fun and cheerfulness than the first 3 minutes of that movie.
Yeah, well, the Happiness Hotel scene is pretty cheerful too, and
that's true.
You know, about how depressing this hotel is, and it's like the most infectious, catchy song ever.
Yeah, and there's even the lyric, you know, though the whole joint's gone to hell, welcome home to the Happiness Hotel.
Yeah, so I felt like Jason Segel and Brett McKenzie, like, they definitely tap into that. And, I think they were big fans of that, and they made sure to, you know, they wanted to return to that. And they actually had the chops to do it. God bless them. Because I think a lot of people think, you know, oh, yeah, we're going to go back to this time and place. But it's kind of a hard thing to, you know, recreate that lightning in a bottle. So I don't think they totally did. I think they ended up doing something new and different. And the reason why I keep kind of going back to this idea that it's in some ways it's more of a Flight of the Conchords movie than a Muppets movie is because I felt like all the really funniest parts of the movie, like the musical numbers, were really human driven rather than Muppet driven.
You're right.
Whereas in the past, the Muppets are always the main characters and they're the ones that are singing the songs and they're the ones doing all the main action. And in this, like, Amy Adams and Jason Segel get a lot of screen time and end up being the ones sort of driving the songs. And even though, like, you know, like this, like the song Man or Muppet,
yep,
or Muppet Man or whatever it was called, like that's straight out of Flight of the Conchords. And to the point where, like, the scene where he's like singing in the rain and looking up at the camera, like all those shots, like they do that stuff on Flight of the Conchords all the time. And the fact that it was all him and not Kermit. You know, it's like, yeah, okay, Walter, but he's a new Muppet, you know, he sort of cuts in, but it's really Jason Segel driving that. And the Me Party song, which is hilarious, it's really funny, but it's Amy Adams and Miss Piggy's just singing back up.
Yeah, you're right.
And the opening number is Jason Segel, Amy Adams, they're the ones singing. Walter's there a little bit, but he even drops out for a little bit of that and sort of disappears for a while. So for me, like, that's a little bit problematic as a Muppet fan, like if I'm going to be like, oh, the hardcore Muppet fan, because here they are, they're bringing back the Muppets. They're doing this movie that's like, oh, remember how great the Muppets were? Remember how great the Muppets are? But they really don't give the Muppets enough to do except go down a nostalgia trip.
Yeah, you're
and
right.
And most of the best Muppet moments are callbacks and references, not just to the Muppet movies, but to the Muppet show. Which is something that Jim Henson never even did. Like, there's sort of this weird thing for me where I'm like, if Jim Henson was alive, this movie never would have ever happened because Jim Henson never looked back. He always kept moving forward. And every time he would do a new project, he would change it up. And even when he got the chance to do new Muppet shows, he always wanted it to be different. He never wanted to just be like, let's bring out that old set. Let's bring out those old songs. Let's bring back all those, you know, the exact same characters. He always was trying to introduce new characters and bring new elements, you know, a lot of which came out of the performers and a lot of it which came out of the puppet builders, rather than what Jason Segel did, which is sort of cherry pick his favorite Muppet moments from the past, going back and saying, oh, we got to have the Muppet Show intro because we love that. We got to do Rainbow Connection. Oh, we got to get Manana Nana in there because, oh man, that thing's a big internet, you know, meme now. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, let's reference this scene in that movie. Let's do, you know, so most of the Muppet stuff is all just sort of like, yeah, the Muppets were great in the past. Why don't you love them anymore? And yet they don't really give them too much new to do. I think there's like two scenes in the movie at the end where like the Muppets do like new sketches. The Smells Like Teen Spirit barbershop thing and the...
Which was really good.
And which is great. Yeah, no, that was like exactly the kind of thing they would do on the show.
Yep. And then the chickens.
Yeah.
That was the high point of the film for me, the chickens scene.
Yeah, well, but that's two, you know, like that's literally 2 minutes of film.
Yeah.
And it's all sort of like set up, getting them back, getting the stage built back together, getting them back so that they're back in the 70s, getting them, you know, right to that moment so that they could do like 2 minutes of new material. And yet Jason Segel, Amy Adams, all of them got to do tons of new material.
Good point. You compare any of the song and dance numbers to Happiness, Miss Piggy from Great Muppet Caper, which is the camera never not on Miss Piggy during that whole, and it's like this big, ridiculous Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers song and dance number, right? In this supper club. Yeah. And yeah, there's all these dudes with top hats and tuxedos all dancing around her, but the camera is always on Miss Piggy, even when like doing the swimming scene with all the choreographed swimming going on.
Because it's about her. Because yeah. The scene is really, I mean, even though it's Charles Grodin's, you know, characters, you know, singing, it's about her.
Yeah.
And in this movie, it's not about the original Muppets, it's about these new characters. It's really their movie. And someone pointed out, you know, sort of adding to my feeling on this, one of the big Muppet sites was saying how Kermit pretty much is one note through this whole film, which is just sort of melancholy and sad and sort of regretful.
Yeah.
So even Kermit never gets to truly be like, what do we love about Kermit? Yes, we love the sincerity, but we also love the confidence and the goofiness of Kermit.
And watching him unspool whenever things start going bad, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was just kind of like, okay, Kermit just gets to be, you know, sad and regretful.
Yeah, he really felt kind of old and weak in this, didn't he? And then I thought it was really interesting that it felt like it was like, and I don't know if this was intentional, maybe this is me mapping it on after the fact, but it felt like that final moment of the film where it shows like Walter and Kermit and Piggy and everybody together, and like Walter is dead center and Kermit and Piggy are off to the side, and it felt like, oh, this is a changing of the guard, maybe. This is like, oh, well, now we're going to focus on him. Kermit's the old guy who's like passing it on to this young guy.
Which, to be honest, I actually wouldn't have too much of a problem with that. And there's a whole...
Want to go into that?
There's a whole Muppet fan philosophy that sort of works on this idea of that Kermit should have stepped aside years ago. And I sent you an article about that.
Yep, I read it. And this is something I personally struggle with. I mean...
I do too. And I'm going to say, like, I sent you that article as a, let's address this, but... There's a certain part in that article where I completely jump ship. and just to get people who are listening, if anybody's still listening, up to context, because the Muppets are, at the end of the day, they're performers. They're not cartoon characters where many hands are touching them and, you know, Mickey, you know, my wife Raina tried to be like, oh, but isn't it like Mickey Mouse where at a certain point, Walt Disney stopped doing the voice of Mickey Mouse. It's like, no, it's different because, you know, at the end of the day, it was Ub Iwerks who was like doing the performances of Mickey Mouse, and Walt Disney just came in and just did the voice after the fact, and lots of different people sort of were animating the character over the years. You know, it used to be that one person did Kermit the Frog for most of his life and most of his career. It was always Jim Henson, and it's a single person performing it, doing the voice. And at a certain point, Steve Whitmire, who was a longtime Muppet puppeteer, took over after Henson died. And the philosophy is that it's still like one guy took over. And it's not like, oh, now lots of people play Kermit and anyone could just sort of put the puppet on and do it as long as they can do the voice. It's like, no, Steve Whitmire is Kermit now. Bill Beretta, you know, has taken over for certain characters. Eric Jacobson does Fozzie now. It's, you know, someone takes it over and they are that character. And I've actually, I for the most part, really love that and respect that and think that that's, you know, one of the cool things about the Muppets is you know that it's a person behind everything. But this article that I linked to tried to make the argument that, you know, once Henson died, no one should have ever taken over Kermit, and that, you know, whenever they see Steve Whitmire performing Kermit, it's like, you know, somebody animating the corpse of their dead mother or some crazy analogy.
Yeah, that is certainly, you know, where
which I think is a little bit harsh. And then and that article also goes on this whole tangent where they're trying to blame Disney and sort of, you know, the corporation thing for all this, you know, selling out of the Muppets or whatever. And I don't buy any of that. I think that if people, you know, that it's sort of revisionist history because long before Disney bought the Muppets, you know, the Henson Company, they tried to do new Muppet shows where Kermit and the other original Muppets sort of were off to the side, and they were trying to sort of phase those out to make room for new characters and new performers to sort of have their voice, which I was a huge fan of. I love Muppets.
So you liked Clifford?
I don't love Clifford, but I appreciate the sort of philosophy of that. I appreciate that Kevin Clash, you know, was one of their main Muppeteers. He had this character Clifford, you know, it's this sort of letting the characters, you know, trial by fire. And if they work, let them continue. If they don't work, you know, phase them out. I love Pepe the Prawn, and Pepe started as a really small character on Muppets Tonight. He was just like in a small little sketch, but he was hilarious. And he was part of a duo. There was another character that was with him. That character didn't work. They phased that character out. Bill Beretta, who's one of the main Muppeteers, he just sort of brought that character to life, and it sort of just kept going. Love or hate him, Elmo was exactly the same way.
Yep.
Elmo started off as just like a background Muppet on Sesame Street, but Kevin Clash started finding things to do with him and sort of brought him to life, and now he's one of the most popular, you know, creations. I feel like the new Muppet movie sort of does not allow for that, because it's saying you're cherry picking your characters. You're saying, okay, it has to be these characters, even though, you know, Rolf the dog was performed by Henson, Kermit's performed by Henson. You know, most of those main characters, the performers are either dead or too old to perform them, or, you know, off doing other things. So they are a little lifeless. There is a little bit of like
Statler and Waldorf. When Richard Hunt died, Statler and Waldorf suddenly showed up with those, and they were played by core original Muppeteers, right?
Dave Golan still does one of them.
But yeah. But man, without Richard Hunt playing Statler, it suddenly kind of felt a little tinny to me.
Yeah.
You know? And
yeah, it's because they're doing an impersonation rather than being them. I mean, Henson didn't have to try to do Kermit 90% of the time because it pretty much was him. It's just a little bit of an altercation to his voice. Now, when you watch Fozzie or Miss Piggy, it's like there's certain lines where you're like, oh yeah, he's getting Frank Oz, you know, dead on in a certain range. But if he goes out of a certain range, it's like, oh, now he's actually starting to sound like Grover. Or now he's starting to sound like Whereas Oz was better at sort of keeping these characters separate, because for him, he knew where the lines were that shouldn't be crossed. And it was just natural for him because it was they were extensions of himself. Now you've got performers who are sort of, you know, channeling another performer's take on it rather than bringing their own spin to it. I mean, every now and then they'd bring a little bit of something new to it, but it's still, they're in this cage. And I think that that's kind of too bad. I mean, but at the same time, and this is where I'm Mr. Contradiction, I understand the need to have the familiar characters in there to a certain extent. And I think that Muppets Tonight was an example where they struck a nice balance. And I think that Muppets in Space also, and some of the movies that happened after Henson's death, even though not everybody's fans of these movies, they were trying to sort of phase, you know, they were bringing in some of the new characters, but they kept enough of the old characters around, maybe not in as central of roles. And I thought that was kind of the smart balance to hit. Whereas now it's like, because it's just the classic characters, it's weird. It's like all the characters are pretty much impersonations. And there's like little nods to the newer Muppets in the new movie, but like it's real small. Like Pepe has like a 30-second scene, and Bobo the Bear.
Bobo the Bear. You know, I hope they keep that as a running gag, that Bobo is always the crony for the bad guy in the movie, because I think that works terrific. He was terrific with Jeffrey Tambor, and he was awesome in this new one with, I forget the name of the actor, but the bad guy, Richmond, Mr. Richmond. Yeah. He's a great lackey.
Yeah, no, he's great. But that's an example of, to me, like they of them needing time to experiment and sort of play and figure these things out rather than just write it. Like, I think that this movie, because Jason Segel's so detached from the Muppets, he just sort of chose all the characters, whether or not there was a reason for them or not. Like, there's certain characters in there that it's like, oh, it's cool to see that old evil Muppet that was the other henchman.
Yeah.
Because that guy's like from the original Muppet Show, like early seasons.
Yep.
But
all the Vincent Price skits. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's like, why is he there in the movie? It's just because Jason Segel liked him.
Yeah. Yeah. His you know? his change of heart at the end of the film felt like it was like, where did that come from? That was weird.
Yeah. The whole last 10 minutes of the movie are a little rushed and sort of uncertain.
It had its moments, though. I mean, like when Walter discovers his talent, I thought that was cute. That was a very Muppety kind of talent.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then
I
also,
love Andrew Bird, so it was great too. Whoop. That was his whistler.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, Andrew Bird is this great, like, alternative.
Yeah, I'm familiar with
violinist and whistling expert.
See, I missed out on a lot of the musical references too, but because I didn't know what the chickens were actually singing, and somebody told me after the fact. I was like, oh. But anyway, and like the moment where like they're doing a telethon, and like when Mr. Richmond like kicks the telethon thing, and it shows that they actually weren't like a dollar away from winning, and they actually only made like a little bit of money.
Yeah, yeah.
That was cute. But yeah, like the final change of heart of one of the henchmen just felt like it came out of left field, and, you know, just from a storyteller standpoint. But, you know, I want to go back.
It was also strange because Bobo disappears for a long time. Like, it's like he has two henchmen. One of his henchmen turns on him, but the other henchman is just sort of like faded away and doesn't show up again until like the closing credits. It's a little, there's like, I don't know. I kept waiting for him to come back and do something. Like I remember thinking, oh, he's going to like show up with like the money that they needed or something. Like, he was going to like, you know, like it was like they're a dollar short and he was going to have the dollar.
Yeah.
Or Reyna said it, like the hobo character,
UHF. The hobo
would like be like, oh, here's a dollar or something.
Yeah. That I was totally expecting that with the hobo in the audience. I thought they're not going to do what they did at the end of UHF Weird Al Yankovic's movie. Are they, where the hobo comes up at the last second with like the thing to help?
Oh yeah. I forgot about that. Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised, because they're probably fans of that movie too.
But I want to go back a second, because like what you're highlighting here is a problem with anything that becomes a franchise, yeah. You know? And this is one of the things where I'm just as conflicted as you are about this kind of thing. Because like, okay, let's talk about Transformers just for a second. And not because I always try to rope them into the conversation, but because it totally is similar in certain respects. It's a franchise of trademarks that it is in Hasbro's best interest to keep alive. It's in their best interest to keep using the name Optimus Prime as many times as possible. And I'm in that tiny minority camp who says, you know what? Rodimus Prime was a really interesting idea. It's too bad they bailed on it, because third season, along comes this young leader who doesn't know what he's doing, and he has to learn how to be the Optimus Prime we love from the previous seasons. And then fans hated it, so, well, let's bring back Optimus Prime. And you know what? After all, that's a good trademark to hold on to. Let's keep that. So every Transformers iteration from now until Doomsday will be Optimus Prime leading them in some form or another, which is kind of a bum out, because it seemed like there was so many opportunities for, well, let's see what the next leader does. Let's see what the next leader does. We can iterate on that concept rather than on the name. So as a reflex to that means that you're always going to have the same characters, but they're going to iterate the characters in certain ways so that each series feels a little bit different as a whole. But you miss out on some really interesting storytelling places to go when you are stuck with a core group of characters. And it's in Disney's best interest to keep Kermit the Frog a viable trademark.
I understand that.
Yeah, I know you do.
But you're right, but they can't grow. They can't evolve. And I think that's... You know, one of the disappointing things about this movie is that it wants to be a reset button. It wants to, you know, the positioning that Jason Segel had when he was talking about this movie was that it's like, oh, you know, people are tired of like these parody movies and the sort of more recent Muppet movies. So we want to bring it back to the to its roots. You know, about them putting on a show, and I want to, you know, get back to them, you know, putting on a show. And I understand that that's great. Those original movies, you know, are fantastic, but it's a little short-sighted because the second movie really isn't that. Like the second movie isn't about them putting on a show.
Second
movie was Henson trying something different. He didn't just repeat what the first Muppet movie did. And even the third movie, although, you know, the third movie sort of revisits a lot of the themes of the first movie, it's still not exactly the same thing. It's not the road trip. It's not the exact same story. It's a similar type of story, but it's at least different enough. And I felt like not only was this trying to go back to, you know, the original Muppet movie, but it also was totally rehashing another Muppet movie that almost nobody has seen, called The Very Muppet Christmas, A Very Merry Muppet Christmas.
I've seen this. I saw it once years ago.
It was very under the radar because it was a made for TV movie, and it was during this black period that they're referencing, where nobody paid attention to the Muppets, and the Muppets were, you know, pretty much a dead property. It was actually like right before Disney bought them, I think. So it was like one of their last ditch efforts to try to get people to pay attention to them. But the plot is exactly the same as this movie, with the exception of the human protagonists. It's the Muppets are about to lose their theater because rather than a rich person named Richman, it's someone named Bitterman, who they've got, you know, a certain amount of time to raise a certain amount of money. So they're going to put on a last ditch show to, you know, to fundraise, to pay off this, you know, evil person so that they can keep the Muppet Theater. And there's even like a lot of the same scenes where like Kermit's like trying to call his celebrity friends because they need a celebrity guest. It follows the format like really, really closely.
Wow.
And in some ways, like you could just watch scenes where you're just like, wow, this is like the same movie. They just tried different things. Like they're just like, okay, well, here's two ways you could play this scene. One was in the Jason Segel movie and one was in this movie. But one of the big differences is there are some of the newer Muppets in there. You see the performers trying different things. It's not a perfect movie. I mean, it's got its flaws. I think all the Muppet movies post Henson are, you know, I have some really great things about them, and some of them are pretty eye rolling and of their time. But that's something I think that the Muppets will always suffer from. I mean, you can't make a bunch of kids sit down and watch the original Muppet Show and expect them to like really appreciate, you know, Sandy the guest
Duncan.
Stars and all the,
yeah, yeah,
the, you know, the tropes of the 70s variety hour shows, and they're going to be dated. You know, I love Muppets in Space. I really do. But there's a scene that's like the characters from Dawson's Creek are in there in character, and it's just painful.
But I mean, couldn't one argue that that is like one of the tropes that Segel missed out on, is that they were always of their time. Charles Grodin, you know, or Steve Martin or Bob Hope or Richard Pryor or any of these people who were in any of these movies, they were just the big stars of the time. So shouldn't that? And you know what? The funny thing is when I was walking into the Muppet movie, the new one, I was dreading that aspect of it. And now that I think about it a little bit, I'm like, well, isn't that part of what always made them work in the first place?
But I don't think that, you know, I don't think they were dependent on that. And I think that this, what's actually enigmatic to me is that it's like this movie makes fun of this idea that like, oh, the Muppets, you know, have all these relationships to like all these dead celebrities or all these old celebrities that are completely of the 70s or 80s. There's like a scene where he's like trying to call Molly Ringwald or something.
Yeah, like, the first person he calls is President Carter. I thought that was actually kind of cute.
Yeah, it's cute. It's a funny gag.
Yeah.
But it's a little strange because it's, again, the Muppets have done plenty of things since the 80s. But what's weirder is that all the celebrity guests that are in this movie, and there are plenty of them, and supposedly a lot of them got cut for time or whatever, they don't have anything to do. Like most of the cameos, with the exception of like one or two, it's like they're there, but like they're really just playing extras. Like anybody could have played them. Like there's no, like they didn't bring any of their, like what they're known for or get to like do anything funny. Like just for example, like if you watch Community, there's the Donald Glover makes a cameo and it's like, he's just like a page and he doesn't like say anything funny or do anything funny. He's just kind of there. And like Alan Alda or who's the guy from Taxi?
I know who you're talking about. I forget his name.
Yeah, he's like one of the celebrities, you know, in the telethon scene, but like he doesn't have any lines. He doesn't do anything. It's just strange.
Well, you know, but then again, I think of Peter Ustinov in Great Muppet Caper where he just plays a truck driver and then he just gets thrown out of the truck. And then they even refer to the fact that he doesn't really do much because.
But at least they call it attention to it. They're like, what, you know, this was sort of like a wasted cameo. Like they're making a joke out of the situation.
That's true.
Where in this one, like Sarah Silverman plays a waitress and it's like, for what reason? Like it's not even like, you know, when Steve Martin played the waiter in the original Muppet movie where he's kind of doing the Steve Martin shtick.
Yeah, that's true. That's
or
true.
Mel Brooks shows up and he's kind of doing a Mel Brooks shtick.
Yeah, good point.
I mean, sometimes that stuff can be dated and painful after the fact, but at least you understand why they brought these people in, whereas this time it just felt like they were around, so they were like, hey, just stand here and be this person.
You're there for star spotting. But, you know, another thing that I think about, one of the moments that caught me off guard, and I'm still...
Judd Hirsch. That's what I was thinking of. Judd Hirsch.
Ah, that's... Yep, that is his name.
He is in this movie.
That's funny. I didn't even see him. Was he answering phones or something?
Yeah, he was answering phones, but he has no line of dialogue whatsoever.
Funny.
You know, it's at least Mickey Rooney gets a little, like, wink.
Yeah. one of the things that caught me off guard was the part when the Swedish chef finds his old refrigerator.
Oh yeah,
and I'm still chewing on that scene. Still trying to figure out like how I feel about that because both Ann and I like jumped back in our seats when he opens the fridge and the talking food is all moldy and then he torches the food.
Yeah,
and it reminded me of an argument that some people level, and I want to defer to your call on this, Dave. I really am interested in your thoughts on this because you think about this way more than I do. You know, Jim Henson gets sort of categorized in two ways. One, the saccharine sweet, making millions of people happy. You know, Fraggle Rock, let's create a series that will bring joy and happiness to all the children of the world. You know, reportedly that's what he said when he came up with Fraggle Rock, or words to that effect.
Yep.
And then there's the people who come in and say, no, he was like, under that sweet veneer was like this serious counterculture artist who wanted to shake up the world.
Yep.
And
he was
so,
both. He was absolutely both. And I just came back. I actually just went to the Jim Henson exhibit that's at the Museum of the Moving Image in Astoria, Queens. I think it's a traveling show.
I need to move to New York.
Well, actually, it was funny because it was actually at the Smithsonian for a while, and I kept like, oh, I got to drive down to Washington, D.C. And I came so close to like going down to Washington, D.C. to see this exhibit. It didn't end up happening for, you know, logistical reasons. And then it ends up coming to the museum that is literally in my neighborhood. Like, it is walking distance from me.
Oh my God.
And it's been there for like 2.5 months, and I just finally went to see it, and I felt like the guiltiest person ever. It's like right there. They have Kermit the Frog and Rolf and all these great puppets from the Dark Crystal, and it's just sitting there. Anyways, but they really do, like, they focus on his career as a whole, and they definitely, like, you know, show a little bit of his, you know, his middle ground period there where he was definitely wanted to shake up the world. And he definitely had all sorts of, you know, he did a documentary about called like Year of 68 or something. I forget the year. It was basically just about like, you know, Vietnam and the whole like, you know, social uprising and just, you know, youth culture. And supposedly he was like designing a nightclub for like, you know, crazy hippie stuff. And it just, you know, he was definitely both. He definitely, you know, wanted to save the world and do, you know, really great, wholesome things. But he also wanted to subvert it and, you know, change it up and shake it to its core or whatever.
And, okay, so if we accept that, that's all well and good if you are the CEO of your company, right?
Yep.
But the moment that your intellectual properties get gobbled up by a corporation, and I'm not placing a value judgment on this because I enjoy many, many corporatized forms of entertainment. But you have to accept them as for what they are, is that they are going to be somewhat static in nature because of that. You know, you can't yell at the Muppets for being frozen in time when the engine that was behind their vibrancy in the first place is gone. And I'm not just saying just Jim Henson. I'm saying Jim Henson, Frank Oz, Richard Hunt, and all the people who were there at the beginning, you know?
Yeah, but I don't blame the corporate machine for that. I think that sort of goes back to what I was saying before about how some people think that Disney owning the Muppets is somehow responsible for any of this. I don't think that that's true. I think that the way that I understand it, and yes, I have read way too many articles about all this stuff. my understanding is that Disney may have, you know, let almost anyone sort of have their crack at it. And this thing could have gone in a lot of different ways. So it really was sort of Jason Segel and his sort of purity for what he thought of as the Muppets that, you know, kind of kept this thing as close to the source material as possible. Because Disney has the power to completely reboot the Muppets or completely reset it even further if they wanted to. But I think that they knew that it wouldn't make any money. I think they saw this as like, this actor just had a really big hit movie with Sarah Marshall. He's sort of connected to this whole Judd Apatow club, and you know, he's hot and he's on this hot show. So it was just sort of like, this is like the most A person that's like come in and sort of pitched us a Muppet thing in a while. So let's give it a shot.
But isn't that in itself the corporate machine in play? Right, it's not saying what's the most artful version we can do. What's something that's going to push boundaries or be interesting? Like, I mean, there's a story.
Yeah, but I think that they're coming up against larger forces of expectation. I think it goes back to this idea that if the Muppets, you know, did a movie that just sort of said, you know, forget the past, let's do something totally new and subversive and crazy, and we're going to bring in all these new wacky Muppets and stuff, people would just be like, this is not the Muppets I grew up with, this isn't what I want from the Muppets. You know, people bring their sort of baggage, and that's why, as much as I'm like, it's a big nostalgia fest, Jason Segel was smart because he knew that he knew what the temperature was in the room. Like, he knew that by putting, you know, there's a million clips from the Muppet Show that you could have put in that movie. And what do you end with? Menomina. Because you go on the internet and look that up and you're going to see a billion people doing that.
Yeah.
A million, you know, variations on that meme. So he made a movie that is like, it's the Muppet movie that, you know, is right for the current generation in some ways. Not necessarily for kids, but for people who kind of used to love the Muppets, but maybe haven't been paying attention for the past 12 years.
You sounded almost brokenhearted when you said that.
Yeah. Well, because it's, like I said, I as for someone who has been sort of paying attention in between, it's I would have rather have just watched a movie that, you know, the Muppets got back together in the first 20 minutes and we just got to see some really great funny stuff rather than a whole, you know, another movie about getting the band back together. It's like they have to keep separating them because that's like the classic, you know, got to get them back together storyline that I keep saying, like you were saying, like with every iteration, if you keep going back to these like exact same core templates, it means that you can't do anything else. Like, you know, like what's the next movie going to be? They break up again and have to get back together again. And,
you know, it's tough though. And this is why it's so conflicting, is that I think about something Keith Giffen said about the Fantastic Four. And one of the problems that, let's look at Marvel and DC Comics and how they're constantly rebooting their universes, setting it at zero again, you know, and now we're going to have this time for sure. We're going to have a consistent universe that everything ties into everything else. And all the histories are perfectly explained. And this is why Batman was created in 1938, but he's still 29 years old, you know?
And
Keith Giffen said, well, who cares about all that stuff, just ignore that stuff. And if when you're writing the Fantastic Four, if Reed is a nerd and Ben is grumpy and Johnny's a hothead and Sue is Sue, you've got a good Fantastic Four story. In other words, you don't need to have them grow, just keep telling interesting serialized tales about these characters. That works. So then
that's fair. I think that's fair.
But on the other hand, then, yeah, I totally get where you also want, because the original creator, you know, was growing up. This man, Spider-Man is a great example of this, where if you look at what Ditko wanted to do with Peter Parker and then what happened after he finally got, you know, he essentially got kicked off the book, but he left of his own choice because the conditions were so difficult for him. You know, it's like then Stan Lee just kind of took him down this repetitive cycle of constantly being disappointed and playing to that what made it work in the first place idea. This is what made it work in the first place. Let's keep going back to that. And look at where we are now, where it's like, oh, well, we got to, you know, he can't be married. He's got to be young again. We got to reset the button again. Simpsons works great that way, too. So it's tough. It's tough to really pin down, like, where you fall on that because...
yeah, and I think the Muppets are in a unique position because they're not a narrative in the traditional sense. At the end of the day, they're a bunch of celebrities who make movies and TV shows together.
Maybe that's part of the problem is that we see them as that way. We see them as...
I think that that's not... I think that's what's given them more room to sort of stay relevant over the years than if, you know, they were trying to stick to a continuity. And then this is coming from a guy who literally spent years trying to figure out how Muppet Babies and the Muppet movies can exist in the same universe when how could they have grown up in a nursery together and then met on the road in their, you know, in their 20s or 30s or whatever, and then also have gone to college together in Muppets Take Manhattan. You know, it's like, I think that the best thing to ever happen to me was this revelation that's like, oh, they're actors and they're starring in these movies, and those movies are just stories and they're not really supposed to be continuity. I mean, that's the way they played it. And they address that. Like even in the Muppet movie, Robin says to Kermit, he's like, is this really how the Muppets met? And Kermit's like, no, not really.
Yeah. It's like approximately. No. And this is what I love about the Great Muppet Caper is that you can have Kermit and Piggy fall in love for the first time.
Yep.
Yet they're old lovers who are having a marital spat while they're filming the film. You know, it's like while they're doing the scene where they're going through all of the drama of early romance, suddenly they break character and start yelling at each other like an old married couple, and then go right back into it again with this. It kicks over to the bicycle scene where they're riding the bikes. One of the most romantic Muppet scenes ever.
It's great. Yeah, and I think that was the justification for why they did Muppet Christmas Carol and Muppet Treasure Island and the film that shall never be named, Muppet Wizard of Oz.
I still never saw that one. That's the one I haven't seen.
One day I'm going to go there, but I have seen everything but that. And I mean everything.
Wow.
But because there's a safety there, like it allows them to sort of play and then they can break character and they can do whatever without people thinking that somehow, you know, that this was continuity. Because I think that, you know, the whole, like, did they get married in is such a, like, a strange thing that happened that people are like, are they really married? Are they not married? Did they get, you know, like, it's like, this is like whole extra level of.
Man, that came through loud and clear in the new movie too, where they basically said, no, they're not married, you know? And I was like, oh, really? You know, did we have to? Oh, that bums me out.
Well, I felt like they were hitting this weird middle ground where they were keeping things vague enough that you could sort of assume that maybe they were married, but then they had gotten divorced, but they're not actually saying that they got divorced. That was a weird thing about that. They definitely was like this vagueness to their, because they don't actually ever say how or exactly why they separated or weren't together anymore.
What's your position on that? What I mean, because you've seen all the films, Muppet Family Christmas.
Yep.
Seems to me they were married.
Yeah, and I think I may have read this somewhere that it's like the sort of like it is like the way it is in the film where they thought it was just a scene in a movie, but she tricked him, and I don't know. I have a hard time with that. I'm not sure.
I think, you know, this is going to sound really...
I don't want to choose a side.
This is going to sound awful, but I think it's absolutely wonderful how emotionally upset that all this stuff makes you, and how twisted up you get about it. That's just great.
Yeah. Well, and on the positive side, I mean, you mentioned Muppet Family Christmas. Nothing makes me happier than Muppet Family Christmas.
Oh, are you kidding me? Well, why isn't this on DVD? I mean,
it is. Well, it is, but it's edited. Ooh, Muppets always have problems with editing. It's not their fault though, because Muppets are always using songs that they don't own.
Oh.
And then, you know, they only get the rights for like limited amount of time, or for certain, like they had the rights for VHS, but not for DVD because they didn't put that in their contract because they didn't know DVD was going to get invented. So there is Muppet Family Christmas on DVD, but like there's a good like 5 minutes chopped out of it.
Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah. It still holds up really great because it's such a great special. For people who haven't seen it, this is all the Muppets go to Fozzie's mother's house for Christmas, and the gang from Sesame Street ends up showing up, and then they end up meeting Fraggles from Fraggle Rock, and it's just like the ultimate Muppets all get together. I mean, it's like you're waiting for the Dark Crystal characters to show up at some point.
Yeah, and maybe Jareth from Labyrinth will show
up.
And it closes. It's such a sweet, sweet ending where it closes on Jim Henson washing the dishes.
I bawl every time I see that.
Yeah, it's
especially because it happened like they filmed that thing like maybe 2 years before Henson passed away or something like that. And so every time I see that, I just think about like how he was about to get sick and die right before this.
Well, and it's like almost like
his last time to see them all together.
Yeah. It's as if he's saying goodbye, you know?
It's such a goodbye. And it's a goodbye by saying like, you know, at the end of the day, it's still work. And it's just like, it's him being humble. Like he's like, oh, let's do these dishes, you know, let them have their fun while I, you know, continue to just do the work. You know, it's like,
And also such a simple.
And he's wearing an awesome suit, by the way.
Oh, he is.
He's wearing the most amazing, like, textured patterned suit that's like, wow, where'd he get that? It looks like Jack Skellington from Nightmare Before Christmas. Yeah.
It's like he went to Elton John and Paul McCartney and said, what should I wear? Yeah. But also, like, he simplifies. He has such a great way of, like, simplifying his message of what it really is all about. It's like he says, they look happy, don't they, Sprocket? Yeah, I like it when they're happy. And then time to get back to work, you know. And then that reminds me of the line from the Muppet movie where Dom DeLuise inspires Kermit by saying, you can make millions of people happy. You know, it's not about you can be rich and you can be famous. You can have all this power, all this prestige. It's like you can make a million people happy. Whoa, really?
Yeah. And that's what excites Kermit. He's like, a million people happy. Wow.
and it's nicely bookended by that final moment in Muppet Family Christmas. And it is the best Muppet special of all time. Yeah. Not just because it's like a nerd moment of seeing all the characters in one room together, but there's also really, really good jokes, like when Ernie and Bert are making small talk with
Doc. God, yeah, there's a lot of great I showed it to some friends last year, and when there's a scene with the Swedish chef and Big Bird where Swedish chef thinks he wants to cook Big Bird, and they just have this like really emotional little moment that like is actually like a character moment for the Swedish chef, which for the most part is a one note character.
Right.
Suddenly he has this like change of heart, and like, you know, Big Bird like connects with him on one-to-one, and it's just like, oh my God, it's so amazingly emotional.
And beautifully done, because Big Bird does it guilelessly.
Yeah.
You know?
It's classic Big Bird.
Yep. Cause he's a 6 year old.
Yeah. On this note, I mean, just cause we're getting all the pet peeves and all the little things. Supposedly, Frank Oz objected to this new Muppet movie because
I read that article that you sent.
Because his big beef was the whole storyline of Kermit sort of living in this mansion while all his friends are sort of in squalor, like that. I guess they're like really upset him. Like he felt that was just too far for Kermit to detach himself that much that he would just be oblivious of his friends sort of suffering. Which I totally agree. But I can also disconnect and be like, well, it's just a movie and it's Kermit playing a part again. And it's not, as long as you don't accept this as like, this is reality, continuity, Muppet world. This is just another movie.
So there's always a meta aspect to anything with Muppets in it.
It's what lets me sleep at night.
Oh man, you know, you said when I messaged you to do this recording, you said you had a lot of complicated thoughts on it. Man, did you ever?
yeah,
you know,
it's
no,
crashing I, the surface.
I totally agree, you know, because, like, I mean, again, if we're talking about, well, who does Kermit represent? He represents sort of like the essence and spirit of Jim Henson. That's what we associate with him after all. And, you know, so there's always that meta message of Kermit trying to hold the gang together is what Jim Henson was always doing behind the scenes. So would he sit in a mansion while all of his friends were in squalor? Hell no.
And actually, again, I recommend that people who are fans of this movie, you know, check out It's a Very Merry Muppet Christmas, just for contrast. I mean, not to be like, oh, one is better than the other, because I think the new Muppet movie is actually better than It's a Very Merry Muppet Christmas. But it's a very similar storyline where, again, Kermit feels responsible for, you know, all his friends. Like, it's basically a play on It's a Wonderful Life. So you get to see, like, what's happened to all the Muppets in a world where Kermit doesn't exist.
You know what? What's funny is the one scene I remember very clearly was is when he goes back into town and is discovering the fates of all of these friends.
Yep.
Without in a world without Kermit, he goes into a nightclub where Scooter is dancing in a cage and Sam the Eagle is dancing around with glow sticks.
Yep.
And I remember that striking me as just hysterical, and that felt so true to the original Muppets, where there was something kind of really creepy and grim about it.
That was, I mean, you know, that was them getting as edgy. As I think that special, it was them pushing it as far. It's edgier than the new movie. It's so funny. Like, even though Jason Segel has this, like, sort of pedigree of doing raunchy movies, he made a much more very G-rated movie comparatively than It's a Very Merry Muppet Christmas. Because yeah, there's a lot of sexual innuendo. There's jokes about, you know, basically Miss Piggy becomes like a cat lady that's like a
that's right, I forgot about that.
A Jamaican psychic, you know, like a phone psychic, and she's like living with all these cats, and it's just like really sad and sort of like there's a lot of like sort of like dark commentary and Fozzie's like a pickpocket and but yeah, the scene of Scooter in the go-go in the cage gyrating, I think, is probably that's the most craziest thing they've ever done. And it's like, it's funny because like the music in the background sounds like Nine Inch Nails too. It's like a couple of notes off the song Animal by Nine Inch Nails.
Oh my gosh. Well, you know, and I don't know. I don't think either of us intended on getting to any kind of final conclusion on this.
We just getting it out of our system. We love to talk about these things.
Well, I'm really glad that I got to talk about it with you, because, you know, it's like going back to my experience with it, I was not paying attention to what was happening with it. I saw like the previews and the posters and went, oh no, they're gonna do, you know, another, you know, celebrity studded fart joke infested iteration of the Muppets, and I'm really not gonna have a good time at it. So I intentionally kept my blinders on about it, went and saw the movie, was pleasantly surprised at how, despite the you know, the rampant nostalgia, that it felt like, okay, well, there were some really funny moments, like when Rolf tells, he's like, how come we didn't tell the story of when you picked me up, you know.
That was great.
And they cut to this really quick cut scene of how they got Rolf in, and then he chuckles and says, classic, you know. There were a lot of great jokes like that in there, and
absolutely, it's very funny. And I will say that there's a lot of weird unresolved jokes that seem like they were setting up all these jokes that they never sort of pay off or never do anything with. But you can go on the internet to find out about those. I want to make sure that I just clarify that I did enjoy the movie, and that there were things that I really, really liked about it. And the thing that I'm most surprised about is how much I loved Walter. And like we were saying in the beginning, it's like, this is a character that really could have been so forced and sort of like, oh God, he's like, you know, the cute kid character that you're supposed to relate to, but I don't relate to, you know, he could have been Jake Lloyd in Phantom Menace or whatever. but instead, I think the smartest thing that they did was originally they wanted Michael Cera to do his voice. They wanted a celebrity overdubbing, you know, a performance, which is which to me is a huge Muppet no-no.
Yeah.
And I am so glad. And I think that this is where the corporate machine actually is a good thing, because you have people that are sort of like, no, there's certain things that are, these are Muppet laws. like they talked about another one, the songwriter, Brett McKenzie, really wanted to make a joke about, in Kermit's song, he wanted to talk about how he used to be, when he was just a little piece of felt. And they said, no, you know, Muppets can't refer to themselves as puppets. Like they are Muppets. They are this self-contained thing. You can't, that's, you know, they can break the fourth wall, but they can't acknowledge that they are actually puppets. And I think that that's smart. I think that that's, you know, there is that purity level that they're keeping. And I think that having a performer, you know, whoever performs the puppet is the puppet and is the voice of the puppet. I think that was really smart. And I think that, I think his name is Peter Linz, who performed Walter. I think he did a great job. And I think
was he an original puppeteer?
He is a puppeteer. I mean, he's not, he was a puppeteer that I had to look him up because I do follow, all the new puppeteers. But he has not played any major characters within the Muppets. He's most known for creating characters on a show called Bear in the Big Blue House,
okay,
which was a Henson preschool show.
Yep, I remember that.
So he's been around. He's done stuff for Sesame Street. He's, you know, he actually has like a little. He actually is one of the extras in Muppets in Space when there's like this big crowd scene at the end of the movie. So he's been around, but he this is like the big, you know, this is a huge jump for him. And I think he did a great job. I thought his singing was great. I thought everything about his performance like felt like a real Muppet. I went in ready to not like him. One, for the Michael Cera thing, and two, for at first I was like, oh, the design is not very interesting. I was like, oh, they should have, if you're going to design a new Muppet, why wouldn't you make him more distinct? And then I did a complete 360 and fell in love with the fact of how simple he was. I love that he was sort of like Kermit and is just sort of real basic, like he's just a sock puppet look to him. And yet you get all this emotion and funny expressions from how simple he is. I feel like that in some ways was like the most, you know, going back to the Muppet roots of anything in the film.
Well, and not only that, and I don't know if this was intentional or not, but it reminds me of the McLeod stuff with, you know, the simpler the cartoon, the more we invest ourselves, the more, yeah, we can map ourselves on there, the more he has the possibility to be everybody in the audience.
Yeah, absolutely. But in a way, and they pulled it off. They pulled it off. It was, you know, to me, that's in some ways the most purest thing about that movie was that character and that performance.
And as another note on the Michael Cera thing, this kind of ties into a big chip on my shoulder I have in terms of like voice acting in general, and like how all these animated films always feel like they have to get some kind of celebrity to be in it in order to make it, you know, sellable.
Except Pixar.
Yeah, you're right. Pixar is the one company that doesn't really go like Ed Asner up. You know,
what I love about Pixar is they're like, hey, animator who's working on this movie, you are actually the best person to do the voice of this character. You know,
right.
In Ratatouille, the kid, Linguini, was like one of the animators at Pixar. And a lot of the, like, now with the Toy Story movies, also, like, all some of like the breakout characters are all like animators and people who just are funny people.
Because they have to be. But yeah, but they, I mean.
And that's going back to the Henson thing of just, you know, Richard Hunt had Elmo, didn't know what to do with him, threw him over to Kevin Clash, and Kevin Clash created this character out of it.
I didn't realize that Richard Hunt was the original.
Yeah, he was the original Elmo, but it wasn't the same character. I mean, he was just there. If you watch Muppet Family Christmas, Elmo's in the background. He's one of the many Sesame Street Muppets. Doesn't have a line in the whole thing because they still hadn't figured him out yet. They liked his design. They were like, oh, he's a fun little design, but they hadn't found his voice yet. And it was Kevin Clash who did that. There's actually a great documentary about Kevin Clash.
Called- oh, the Elmo documentary. It's on Netflix, actually.
Is it?
Yep.
Oh, awesome.
I thought it was.
Yeah, it's playing in the city. It's like playing in like art house theaters. And I know it's going to be on PBS next year. But if it's already on Netflix, that's awesome.
I'm pretty sure I saw it on Netflix, but maybe I got to make sure I'm not misremembering. Because I have Apple TV and I got a ton of different menus on there, which I can flip around through. I don't know if I saw it in the iTunes store or not, but I'm pretty sure I saw it on Netflix.
Yeah, it'll be available eventually.
But, you know, this idea of like voice acting and like there's a certain quality of like, and I don't want to just like simplify it down to hamminess, but there's a certain kind of like extra loudness to Muppet voice acting. Like when you think about Red Fraggle, you mm-hmm. know, like she's not just happy. She's really happy. Mookie yeah. Fraggle isn't just pensive and thoughtful. She's really pensive and thoughtful. Right.
Yeah.
So like if you put a Michael Cera in there, oh, man, is that going to feel incongruous?
Yeah, and it's funny because before the movie, there's a trailer for the Smurfs. The CGI Smurfs movie.
Yeah.
And there's this clip of Katy Perry in the voice studio, in the sound booth, talking about, you know, doing the voice acting. And she's like, it's great because it's like, I get to create her character, kind of. And you're just like, no, the character was already created. Like, it's just the idea that, like, these celebrities are, you know, it just drives me crazy.
Yeah, me too.
You know, unless they're right for the character. I mean, that, you know, I'm not going to be like, oh, all celebrity voices are bad.
No,
I mean,
Ed Asner was awesome in Up. He was
absolutely
perfect. But, you know, I mean, it's like when they
cast Patton Oswalt as the rat in Ratatouille, and like nobody really knew who Patton Oswalt was when that movie came out. I mean, now he's more famous, but they just thought that he was the right voice for that character.
Another one I'll give credit to is Antonio Banderas. I just saw Puss in Boots.
Yeah, it's funny. I really don't like the Shrek movies, but I have to admit that I would watch that because I think that his performance, he looks pretty good.
I despise the Shrek movies. I mean, like, and the Shrek movies were what kept me away from DreamWorks films altogether. And finally, some of my students said, you got to watch How to Train Your Dragon.
Dragon's great.
Oh, God, it's awesome. And Kung Fu Panda, I thought I was going to... This is another thing. I really don't like Jack Black, but I loved him in this Muppet movie.
Well, it's kind of, he kind of gets to play to that, I guess, in some ways.
Yeah. being tortured. But like Kung Fu Panda, I thought, oh, Jack Black, man, I can't stand that guy. He's in all those raunchy comedies where it's all about, you know, anyway. But Kung Fu Panda was awesome. And then Puss in Boots comes along. I'm like, it's a Shrek thing, but it's cats doing people things. And so...
Is Shrek in it? Does he
know? If you watch this movie and did not know anything about Shrek, you still wouldn't know anything about Shrek. It's basically Zorro told with cats.
Yeah, that's what I want to see.
And the crazy thing is Antonio Banderas has played Zorro in the past, right?
Yeah.
But he is so much better as Puss in Boots because he takes that performance to like this kind of Ricardo Montalban level of like just chutzpah, you know? Maybe that's the word I would associate with Muppet acting is like there's like this, you know, this unnameable quality, but we'll just call it chutzpah. Where I like him better as the Puss in Boots Zorro than as the real Zorro.
So. I liked him fine as Zorro, but it's definitely a strong performance because it made me want to see it, and I really didn't like Shrek. So.
No, I really couldn't stand Shrek, but this movie I was actually laughing out loud at several points. So, but anyway, I don't want to keep too much more of your time, Dave, unless you have any kind of closing thoughts on this Muppets business. Best Muppet movie.
Best Muppet movie. It's hard. I think.
I know.
They're all, you know, the Muppet movie is probably the best because it does all of the things that the Muppets do. It's got the fourth wall breaking. It's got the irreverency. It's got the sort of, you know, it's deconstructive in the way that the Muppets are. But it also has the sincerity. I mean, Paul Williams soundtrack. I mean, everybody talks about Rainbow Connection, and hey, I had somebody play it at my wedding. I love it. but there's that moment where at the end of the movie where the stage starts to fall apart and Kermit just looks at the camera and starts saying, life's like a movie, write your own ending, keep believing, keep I forget about it. I'm just like, oh my God, it's amazing. Like that's, it's fourth wall breaking, but in the most sincere, like the songs are just so great.
There's a rainbow that falls into the room.
Yeah, a rainbow comes into, I mean, that's like.
And it doesn't. And it's not like a Skittles commercial. It is not MTV, cynical, sneering, ironic kind of stuff. It's like when the rainbow falls in that room, it's like, oh, that's what a rainbow's supposed to mean. It's not a unicorn fart. It's actually something sweet and sincere, and it symbolizes like this kind of the feeling of the ending. And then plus when the entire chorus of all of the Muppets kick in with Kermit.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty perfect. But you know, there's some things in that movie that are a little like, if you're not familiar with the cameos and stuff, although it's not so bad. It's,
you don't have to be familiar with Milton Berle's comedy to appreciate his scene in there.
Right. Yeah. And oh man, the driving, moving right along. Like how can you not have a road trip and want to sing that song?
That's true. Yeah, I guess it probably has the most memorable songs, even more so than Great Muppet Caper. Although Great Muppet Caper does have the Hey a Movie, which I...
Yeah, no, it's got Hey a Movie, it's got Happiness Hotel. There's at least one other like really good song in that. The other songs are okay. I mean, the guy who wrote the Sesame Street songs, he's a genius. But they just don't hit that like emotional chord that Paul Williams songs did. Like they're just, you know, Paul Williams is just like, you know, right to the gut and just sort of a little bit transcendent. Like they're just, you're almost amazed at how he gets away with this like really, really sincere saccharine approach to life. And yet it also feels a little like subversive and weird in its own way. I don't know.
God, I could listen to you talk about Muppets all day.
Cause I think like that's where like the third Muppet movie, although I enjoy it, the songs are good, but they're not, you know, transcendent in that way.
No, you're right. You're right. I mean, the closest they get is the Together Again, which is the opening song.
Like the beginning. Yeah, exactly. That's the, but it, I don't know. It just doesn't,
But like the Look at Me, Here I Am, Right Where I Belong, it doesn't really have the same punch as,
as Rainbow Connection.
Yeah, you're right.
Well, I do like it though. I do like all the songs, and I like that movie.
No, the first three are terrific. I would have to put my chips on the second one or Muppet.
So, Family. What's your least favorite? That's always the one. That's what I'm actually more interested usually in is people's least favorite because
the one,
every time I think, oh, everybody hates that one, and then it's like, no, I like that one. Like really?
That's a toughie because I have not seen Muppet Treasure Island in a long time. I saw that when it came out when I was in my 20s. And I remember that I was young enough to have kind of that stupid, like some holdovers of that teen irony angst stuff and go, oh, this isn't my Muppets. This is the new stupid kitty Muppet. So I remember really walking away feeling cold from that.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually liked Muppets from Space and Muppet Christmas Carol is okay. I think Michael Caine is a little wooden.
Oh, yeah, I think he's pretty good.
My approach to Muppet Christmas Carol is stained by the fact that I grew up every year watching the Albert Finney musical Scrooge. Have you ever seen that?
Yeah, I've seen as many versions of it as I can. I love A Christmas Carol.
And the Ghost of Christmas Present in the Albert Finney Scrooge is the definitive Ghost of Christmas Present in my mind. He's this big, huge, hairy guy who's so cheerfully masculine that it's scary. And then when you go to the music scene with the Ghost of Christmas Present and Michael Caine in Muppet Christmas Carol, it just feels like everybody's half asleep while they're doing it.
It's a little low-key, yeah. But I do enjoy that. I like that number.
Anne fights me tooth and nail. She says it's a great film, and I'm an idiot for not liking it all that much. But
I came around. Like, that was the movie that killed the Muppets for me for a while. Like, when I saw it, that was my teenage, like, ah, the Muppets are dead. You know, this is not Henson. His son will never understand, you know, like all that kind of stuff. There was a Muppet CGI sequence. It was, you know, I wasn't in the headspace that I could actually appreciate it. I also was like in that like, oh, musicals are bad. I wish they'd stop singing thing. And you know, and the songs, even though they're Paul Williams, they're nowhere, you know, they're not on the same level as the first Muppet movie. But I've come around on it. Like a couple of years ago, a friend of mine, like, you know, brought it over and I gave it another chance and I really did warm up to it. I think amazingly, it's a really faithful adaptation of the book of A Christmas Carol. But I also think it's, you know, it's pretty funny and it's also like interesting that they bring in some like Henson type things like the Ghost of Christmas Past, especially, you know, is definitely not like your traditional Muppet. It's definitely like more like something out of Labyrinth or one of its, more experimental films.
And that's another thing we should keep pointing people at is that a lot of people forget sometimes that Dark Crystal and Labyrinth were both Henson movies too. And I would submit that I think Labyrinth is one of the finest fantasy films for young people ever made.
Amen. I have more fondness for the Dark Crystal, but because I think the Dark Crystal is the most like ambitious movie ever made.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Because it's all puppets and you know literally an original world. Top to bottom.
I'm sure you know the story. I mean, I saw this in a Henson documentary years ago, but supposedly when he did the screening of The Dark Crystal, all the executives upon the final credits rolling silently stood up and walked out of the room.
I hadn't heard that, but But I love hearing about how he actually created a language for everyone to speak in the movie, and the whole movie was going to be subtitled.
Oh my gosh, that would have been so cool.
He wanted the whole movie to be subtitled because there is this great quote where he's like, it's an alien world. Why would they speak English?
Oh, man.
But supposedly that was like a deal breaker for the producers. They were like, you have to. And it's funny because you watch that movie and you realize like most of the dialogue is really unnecessary. Like it really is a silent film.
Yeah.
But they just, you know, it's just sort of like emoting.
Like when we're dream fasting, sharing our memories, we knew what they were doing.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious. It's all pretty obvious.
Although I don't know if I would like Agra as much. Well, if as long as it's the same voice actor who's an actress doing Agra.
She's awesome. She's great. But yeah, I love Labyrinth as well.
But Labyrinth just plays its cards a little bit more clearly that, yes, this is a fantasy movie that is created to be sort of like a parable or fable for children.
Yeah, it's Alice in Wonderland. It's Wizard of Oz. It's all...
Oh, well, man,
and
Dave.
And it's David Bowie's crotch and people's gyrating.
that's the part Anne can't stand is like when he starts dancing, she's like, I can't stop staring at that.
Yeah, it's amazing. I never noticed that until I grew up. And then I went to a screening in the city and like, you know, and all my female friends were like, oh, David Bowie, he's crotching them. I was like, what? Really? And then I saw it in the screening and I was like, oh, yeah, it is pretty amazing. There is a lot of camera time on it.
Oh, man. I don't know. I try to avoid that part of it. I'd rather watch Sir Didymus ride around on the dog.
That's awesome.
But anyway, you know, like I said, I could listen to you talk about Jim Henson all day, but I also want to defer to your work schedule because you're working on comics, I take it.
Sure. Yeah, that's what I'm doing.
I thought you were going to watch
some other movies right now.
Anyways,
thanks for having me. Thanks for
No, thank you, man. This was super, super awesome. I needed this. I needed to get this out of my system because I felt like there was something like boiling up inside of me. Like to quote Anne, the description she had is like she had a thousand hearts in her chest and they were all having an attack. I was like, yeah, I kind of need to get this out.
I'm really happy that the movie is doing well, and I'm happy that if it does do its job, you know, because like when I walked out of the movie, I was like, well, if this movie bombs, it'll be the most pathetic thing in the world because here's this movie that's all about how nobody loves the Muppets anymore and how we're going to get them to together and it ends on like, yay, the Muppets are back. But if the movie bombs, then it's just going to like be this like footnote about, you know, how nothing could be done to bring them back.
It's like grandma saying, why does nobody call? And then nobody calls.
Yeah, exactly. Really. That's why I was like, well, my opinion on this movie is going to really change depending on how well it does, which is sad.
Well, but thanks for, you know, helping point out the complicated, you know, here's the final note. Okay. This is the takeaway that I think we can point at is for anybody who's like, why am I listening to an hour and change about people talk about the Muppets? I don't care. Thought this was a comic show. Jim Henson was a complicated man and
he was a cartoonist too.
He was and he was a screen printer, and yeah, you know, he was an artist in every sense of the word. And he get, you know, historically people when they're writing histories, they mischaracterize things, they oversimplify things, and the point is he was a complicated man. He wasn't just this simple, sprightly, sweet guy all the time. And I think that we forget sometimes that we cartoonists are complicated people, and it's okay for us to be complicated and to contradict ourselves, as Dave has just proven. You know, it's like I jokingly, and I really was joking around when I characterized you as the Teddy Ruxpin of comics, just because whenever I spent any time around you or talked with you, I always felt like, gosh, I'm a lot more cynical than I thought, because Dave has such a pleasant and sweet way of looking at things. But
no, I'm the AG Bear of comics.
The AG
Look Bear. That up, 80s reference people.
AG Bear?
AG Bear.
All right, I'll look that up later. I don't know what that is, but anyway,
it was a bear that came out around the same time as Teddy Ruxpin was not anywhere near as popular.
But you know, it's like we're all complicated people, and it's okay to not have some things reconciled. It's okay to be ambivalent about things, you know. So what?
You lost me. Ambivalency? I don't know what that means.
Oh, it can go either way. You can go either way on a topic, right?
Oh, yeah. But I see, I don't view it as ambivalence as much as it's just sort of like this thing that unlocked when I had debate class in high school where it's like you have to learn how to argue both sides of an argument.
Yeah. Yeah.
I never stopped.
I think that's a good way to be. I think that's a really good way to be because that I think overall that does make you a more compassionate human being because you can see both sides of an issue and you're not just demonizing something else. Or, you know, this was the Jim Henson way. You know what? We don't know what the Jim Henson way was. We'd have to ask the man and we can't.
Yeah, yeah. I hate when people are like, this is what Jim Henson would have done. Or it's like, shut up. Nobody knows.
Well, thanks again, Dave. So Dave Roman, yaytime.com, yaytime on Twitter, Dave Roman on Google Plus, the Facebooks and all over the place. Anything, you know, you want to take this opportunity, anybody who was made happy by what they heard from you today, anything you want to point them at?
No, just my book, I guess, Astronaut Academy. That's really what I'm, that's what I'm working hard on right now.
And yeah, and I'll back it up. I've said this before on the show. I'll say it a million other times. Astronaut Academy epitomizes all of the things that we just talked about, all of that kind of sweetness and sincerity and being something that is accessible and good for kids, but is not using the affected voice of a old storyteller speaking down to children. So
thanks.
I mean, I just was talking on the last episode.
And the characters look like puppets.
They do, actually. They do follow. They follow that. That
when I draw them, I sort of feel sometimes like I'm drawing puppets and not people. Actually, and when I colored the cover of Hakata Soy, like I was definitely like he's definitely like an Ernie orange. Like when I was thinking, it's like what color is his skin? He's like he's orange, like Ernie.
No, I was just talking with Tony Cliff on the last episode, and I think at the top of the episode, maybe, I don't know if this was before the recording, or I hope it got recorded, he said that, you know, he went to a convention recently, and he got a whole bunch of books, and the best one he got over the last year was Astronaut Academy.
There's a guy, adult. That Tony Cliff. I see great things in his future. No, I love Tony, actually. I think that he's definitely... one to watch. His book Delilah Dirk and the Turkish Lieutenant is going to be it's gonna be pretty big.
It's gonna be a big deal. Yeah, pretty amazing book. So all right, let's stop the recording. So thanks again, Dave. This was super super awesome, and until next time, everybody, I've been Jersey Drozd, comicsgreat.com, Jersey on Twitter. Okay, bye.
Life's like a moon, it write your own ending. Keep believing, keep pretending. We've done just what we set out to do. Thanks to the love.